Super Micro has vision. Putty keys are unstuck. Micron is cashing in their chips. BMC acquiring Netreo. IBM eyeing HashiCorp. ESXi is open to attack. And Steven and I take on non-competes in this week's Rundown episode. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Wednesday, April 24th episode of the Gestalt IT Rundown. I am your host, Tom Hollingsworth, and one of the things that's always been on my bucket list is to host a weekly podcast. Well, I think I can check that one off. Joining me is my wonderful co-host, Mr. Stephen Foskett. Stephen, welcome to the show.
It's good to be here on National Pigs in a Blanket Day. And for those of you who don't know what a pigs in a blanket are, I pity you.
It's okay, Stephen. Not everybody can enjoy the wonderfulness that is a hot dog and a croissant, but we have all of the great news stories coming your way with some exciting things in store for you in the world of enterprise IT news. We're going to be starting off with a story about Supermicro because at Intel Vision 2024, they unveiled a series of servers powered by Intel Xeon 6 and Intel Gaudi 3 chips, including the first OCP DHMHS motherboard from a major vendor. This new standard extends the reach of OCP from accelerators and network cards to motherboards. But does this signify a shift away from proprietary designs?
Well, first off, I have to give a shout out to my pal Patrick Kennedy over at Serve the Home. His eagle eyes brought this story to us, and I thank you, Patrick, as always. This is really interesting. So, as you probably know, Supermicro is the king of, well, frankly, excellent server designs. In fact, you know, full disclosure, when I built a server for the Gestalt IT office, I use the Supermicro motherboard because, well, they're great. But one thing about Supermicro motherboards is they're also proprietary. And that is great sometimes and not so great other times. As you know, the OCP community has been developing non-proprietary open hardware designs. Most servers now can use OCP network adapters. These are specialized cards in a special form factor, special interface, et cetera, that allow you to have a network card that can fit in almost any server. Yeah, I know that sounds like a PCI Express card, but this is a special one. It's a different form factor. It has more of everything in order to support more of everything. Now, OCP has a lot of other great stuff. In fact, we've gone to the OCP conference a couple of times, and it is really neat. Honestly, if you're a hardware nerd, I definitely recommend checking out the OCP hardware designs. One of those designs is a design for a standard motherboard. Unfortunately, although these motherboards are widely used by hyperscalers, they're not widely available to consumers because, well, a lot of people designing server hardware, well, they want a piece of server hardware that is optimized as much as they can in the envelope that they have, which typically involves a lot of questions beyond just, is this a standard motherboard? I mean, they'll look at things like airflow and packaging and fitting in everything, you know, in terms of power supplies and drives and interfaces and controllers and all those things. They got to make sure that that fits in perfectly. That usually means that it doesn't make sense to use some kind of a standard motherboard. But Supermicro is doing that. So this is kind of neat. They've got a 1U server that they showed that's part of their Cloud DC line. It includes a standard OCP-shaped motherboard, which is this DCMHS form factor. And this is the first time that we've seen a major server OEM using the standard motherboard form factor, which, frankly, is a sign of things to come. I would say that more and more companies are probably likely to use this simply because, like OCP NICs and like standard motherboards in desktop computers, it just kind of makes sense if you're trying to achieve economies of scale to produce standard things. I would not be surprised to see standard DCMHS motherboards in Dell or HPE or somebody else going forward. And I do think that this is a sign of things to come. A big vulnerability in PuTTY could allow attackers to retrieve your keys. This setup for the attack is pretty specific. It requires you to be running a specific version of Windows and use elliptical curve encryption techniques. But if you're running those things, for the private encryption key in your system, guess what? It can be stolen. It could also lead to supply chain attacks. And the insidious part is that this key can also be retrieved if you use it to sign things like Git commits. What do you think about this attack, Tom?
I'm reminded of a shirt that I saw from my friends at Forward Networks one time that says, "I'm right because math." That's basically what we're dealing with here. You don't have to get into the nuts and bolts of things like nonces and elliptical curve technology to understand something that's actually pretty stupid. The way that PuTTY tries to find certain kinds of leftover like moduluses on things is predictable. And basically what this proof of concept says, follow me here, is that if you take this key and you divide it by a certain number around 60 times, you can retrieve the private key of whatever that is. 60, that's it. That's math that you can do on a computer today in less than a minute. And so basically what they're saying is this becomes a very trivial attack to pull off. There's two ways to do this. You can either have SSH access to the system and you can start trying these things, or you can go find some Git commits that were signed with the same SSH key, and oh boy, now you have a field day with it. Like I said, it's for PuTTY. It has to be running this very certain version of Windows that's weak against this, and I'm sure we're going to patch this out very soon. But the important thing is, I think this should be something out there that everybody is realizing. Don't use the same keys for SSH that you use for a lot of other things. You should have different keys in your key ring. Just like the key that starts your car shouldn't be the one that opens your front door. I mean, logically speaking, they can't be the same door. But, you know, all those people who are like, yeah, my front door and my back door key are the same. Well, then you've literally just doubled your attack surface, because if I have the key to one, I have the key to both, right? And that's one of the things that we're dealing with here. Supposedly elliptical curve encryption technology is supposed to be more resistant to this kind of stuff, but the problem isn't in the way that elliptical curve encryption works. It's in the implementation of the ECC on this system, because they're using shortcuts to reduce the time that it takes to find an encryption key. So I'm hoping that there's going to be a patch pretty soon to take care of this particular problem, and also that people learn a little bit more about encryption key hygiene from this in the future, and make sure you have multiple keys, that you're not signing your Git commits with the same thing you're using to log into secure systems, and so on and so forth. The U.S. has earmarked about $30 billion worth of funding for the CHIPS Act to support domestic semiconductor manufacturing. We've previously reported on amounts received by Intel, TSMC, and Samsung. That means there's about $6 billion left in the fund, and that is reportedly the amount that Micron will be receiving. Does this close the CHIPS Act, and is the U.S. going to be getting what it's asking for?
Yeah, I think that this is a really interesting story because, well, first off, it hasn't been announced yet. So the rumors say that President Biden will be going to Syracuse, New York, to announce this tomorrow. Assuming that that's what happens, then, you know, Micron would basically get the remainder of the grant money. Now, as you may know, the CHIPS Act actually has $114 billion of government incentives, but a lot of that is loans and tax incentives and other things. Of the grant money, basically cash money given out to companies to do stuff, this would represent the end of it. As you mentioned, we've talked a lot about the CHIPS Act on the rundown. Some of our fans are probably tired of hearing us talking about it, but I figured we would be remiss if we talked about Intel's funding and TSMC's and Samsung's, and we didn't mention Micron. Micron was basically the last man standing. I think there were some people wondering, you know, hey, how come they didn't get any CHIPS Act funding? Well, I think they're going to, and I think it's going to be about $6 billion, because that's about what's left to give out. That would be about the same as some of the other companies have received in direct grants. I think there could also be some other aspects to this that we could see. There could be loans. There could be other incentives coming from the federal government, as well as from the state of New York. Reports suggest that the governor of New York will be there as well, and she's likely to try to support it as much as she can, though I doubt that they've got billions to hand out. In addition to the companies that we mentioned, by the way, I should also mention that BAE Systems, Microchip Technology, and GlobalFoundries also received CHIPS Act support. And again, this all points to Micron getting what's left. Micron has also talked previously about the fact that they were eyeing expansion overseas, for example, And I think that that may have been a way for them to make sure that they got what was coming to them and that they got a fair share in comparison to some of these other companies. Overall, this looks like a big investment. Micron, of course, is in Boise, Idaho, and they are doing a lot of expansion in the upstate New York area. And I think that this is a way for upstate New York to make sure that it's got its share of funding as well. And this, I think, overall is a good move. New York is a great place. There's lots of workers there. There's lots of water, lots of power. Makes a lot of sense. Kind of like Ohio makes sense for Intel. And kind of like some of the other locations leave some of us scratching our heads. Will the U.S. get what they want? Well, they're certainly going to get manufacturing. The question is, what is going to be manufactured? How much of it is going to be purely domestic? And will it actually make sense for customers to use this? Essentially, I think it's important to remember that all this money is going to fund factories without products to make necessarily. The next step is going to be for all of these companies, Intel, Samsung, TSMC, and Micron, to decide what to put there. Many of them will likely put their own products in there, except TSMC, which doesn't have its own final products. Certainly Intel, Samsung, and Micron are likely to use their factories to produce their own finished products. But beyond that, I think everybody recognizes the fact that every one of these companies has to find customers. And those customers have to be willing to work with new fabs in new areas. Plus, we've heard some rumors about difficulty in terms of getting employees that want to work the way that these companies want to work, culture clashes between the especially with TSMC and American workers. And I think a lot of that stuff is things that we're going to have to overcome in order to get these factories up and running and for the U.S. to get the kind of payout that it wants from this funding. BMC is picking up observability company Netrio. BMC is excited about the full-stack observability solution from Netrio and how it offers a glimpse into networks and applications. Netrio also utilizes OpenTelemetry for their solution, which is an area that BMC is looking to grow. The goal is to integrate the solution into BMC's existing Helix AIOps platform.
I will say that Stephen Dickens over at the Futurum Group did a really great job of running down the aspects of this acquisition, which are super important to people out there in the industry. I mean, you need to have an observability solution if you're trying to offer these kinds of things to your customers where you want to be like the all-in-one stop shop. And it's not just observability of infrastructure. You have to know the network conditions. Otherwise, your cloud can be down for no reason and you don't understand why. And you also have to understand application observability, because if you don't understand how the applications are interacting with the network and with the infrastructure, you could have green lights across your board and things are still down because of something in a function call in the application that just isn't working out. The thing that had me the most excited, though, is this idea of utilizing OpenTelemetry. A lot of you out there that are watching the show may be too young to know why SNMP both gives everybody hives, but is also magical. And it's magical because it is a standard and because you can pull devices and get information from them without having to hack together some weirdness. Now, granted, again, going back to the hives part, SNMP is very much like a product of its time, and it doesn't do everything we want it to do. That's why we started to embrace things like APIs and stuff like that. But when we jumped into that market, APIs are very proprietary. You have to worry about things like, well, am I writing to the right spec, and how does this work, and why am I not getting the information that I want? And OpenTelemetry solves a lot of those problems because it standardizes the process. If the company supports OpenTelemetry, you can write code against that, and you know it's going to work because you're writing it to a standard. And the fact that BMC is not only committed to doing this, but they're acquiring Netrio to make sure that they do have that functionality is a big win for me. I hope more companies want to adopt OpenTelemetry. Yes, they're losing a little bit of their secret sauce, but let's be fair. People have been writing weird SNMP MIBs for years and adding a little extra functionality on top of it, but it's still all working off of the same base system. I think that this is a huge win for everyone. And like I said, Stephen Dickens has a great rundown of this in the Futurum note that we're going to attach here in the show notes. But, go out there and take a look at it. And I think this is a great reason for people to be looking at, you know, using BMC for a lot of their solutions, but also Netreo customers to be excited about what this means for their future. There was a big report this morning from Reuters that says that IBM is nearing a deal to acquire HashiCorp. The move is reported to be in furtherance of their cloud offerings, which is what a lot of the IBM acquisitions as of late have been about. HashiCorp's stock price surged on the rumors and pushed their market cap north of $6 billion. Of course, neither party is commenting, and Reuters did mention that while the talks are expected to be finalized in the coming days, there is just as much chance that no deal could come out of the reports. However, all of the analysts are abuzz at the fact that IBM could be making this big deal for HashiCorp. Stephen, what's your take on this news?
Well, I think this makes a lot of sense. As my good friend Keith Townsend pointed out, about a year ago, HashiCorp really needed the kind of high-touch sales that IBM provides, and it makes a lot of sense for this acquisition to go through. I know that some people are rending their garments and pulling their hair about the idea of HashiCorp going to IBM, but remember that IBM has done a pretty darn good job with Red Hat. Although obviously there have been some hiccups and bumps and so on, what I hear from customers and importantly from employees over at Red Hat is that things are going pretty well and that IBM has been a pretty good caretaker for the market and has provided the things that their open source and software and services companies need, like enterprise support and enterprise sales, without totally screwing up the company and screwing up the product, which, you know, honestly, IBM deserves some credit for. I would say overall that this is really what HashiCorp needs as well, and that IBM is likely to be at least as good a steward for HashiCorp as they have been for some of these other acquisitions. My question is, will Hashi become part of Red Hat? Will it remain a separate entity? And how will this change the go-to-market? Another thing I'd like to call out, again, as Kelsey Hightower pointed out as well, one of the things that IBM could do, and this is not completely nuts, is to quickly move all the HashiCorp products over to a respected open license like Apache 2.0. If they did that, they would be seen as heroes in the open source world, and frankly, that would really help IBM in terms of capitalizing on this acquisition. So shout out to Kelsey and shout out to my friends at Hashi and my friends at IBM and Red Hat. Hey, what a great idea. But even if they don't do that, I think that the acquisition makes pretty good sense and I'd be interested to see where it goes. The VMware by Broadcom ESXi hypervisor is being exploited again. This time, the attack involves authentication bypass through compromised file uploads. The zero-day exploit in the shell service was uncovered on hacker forums this week and is apparently being actively used in the wild right now. There's a patch available to remedy the situation, but questions remain about how companies are not signed up for service and support contracts can obtain this patch. What do you know about this, Tom?
Well, first things first, if we're talking about the exploit, this is not very good, right? All I'd be able to do is I can exploit the shell service, I can get shell access, log in as a VPX user, upload a file with a Python script, and the next thing you know, I have complete access to your hypervisor. That's bad, right? We obviously don't want that. These kinds of bugs happen quite frequently, especially as people, you know, fuzz new exploits and techniques and stuff like that. By the way, $1.5 million worth of Monero is what this was going for on the hacker forums where it was uncovered. So, you know, somebody is going to be making a buttload of money off of this. Here's the problem that I have with this. How do you patch your hypervisor? You just go download the patch, right? Aha. What if you don't have service and support? That's one of the problems that we've seen from companies like Microsoft for a number of years, right? Because I get it. From the perspective of a company that is not wanting to keep around developers who still write code for Windows XP, like those are people that are not going to ever really get retrained in new methods or things like that. And keeping those people on the payroll is a bad idea. unless you have people who are paying you to support those job functions, right? We all know that there are a lot of automated teller machines that still run on things like Windows XP. Well, as long as the ATM companies are paying Microsoft to keep that developer on staff to write this code, great. But now we look at what Broadcom, now the owner of VMware, wants to do, and they want to be able to get revenue from those kinds of things. Well, that means moving this to service and support contracts. And you would think, oh, not a big deal. I'll just pay service and support. Well, some people aren't able to do that. I will tell you that I have seen a link to an underground VMware patch distribution hub where people who are not under service and support can go download said patch and make sure they are updated against that hypervisor. Again, I'm not going to tell you where to go find that because that violates VMware by Broadcom's terms of service. I'm saying that the community is jumping ahead of this problem to make sure that they cannot be actively exploited in the future. We have seen stories in the last couple of weeks where Hawk Tan has basically had to admit that maybe this idea of transforming VMware overnight into this subscription revenue giant isn't working out the way they wanted to. And they're going to have different kinds of rules for people who are in the middle of that transition. The install base for the VMware ESXi hypervisor is so huge that they really have to look at the possibility that they're going to have to offer security patches like this free and available for anyone who wants to download them, so that you're not going to be dealing with a PR nightmare once we find out that someone got shell on your hypervisor and started going ham on all of your VMs. We had a closer look story this week, and boy, it's a doozy, because in a landmark ruling, the U.S. Federal Trade Commission has ruled that non-compete clauses in employment agreements are no longer valid, and all existing non-compete agreements 120 days from today are null and void. The government argues that non-compete agreements stifle wages and reduce the talent pool for all companies to draw from. Now, if you ask the businesses, they're going to tell you that they need to protect their intellectual property and development processes. The ruling came after 26,000 public comments were made on this case. After the ruling was issued, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce immediately filed suit and challenged the ruling as well as the FTC's ability to decide it. Now, there was similar action that was expected from the National Labor Relations Board around this same topic, and there were some that were saying that the FTC was kind of in a race with the NLRB to figure out who could get the news out the fastest. This is a big issue in enterprise technology because, according to the reports, 1 in 5 Americans are covered by a non-compete agreement at any given time right now. Stephen, what should we make of the FTC's decision to invalidate all non-competes?
Well, first off, I think that maybe we should talk a little bit about non-competes generally, because this is one of those things that you and I, Tom, when we go to Tech Field Day events or other events and we're talking to people from other countries and we mention non-competes, there's usually a lot of, wait, what? But this is not specific to the United States. There are non-competes in other countries as well. And I think that it's important also to point out that non-competes are somewhat controversial even here in the U.S. For example, in California, they've moved pretty aggressively to get rid of or to block any non-competes. And in fact, California won a major court case showing that they can invalidate the non-competes of other other states if somebody moves to a company in California. And that's a big, big deal. Similarly, we've seen a little bit of a back off from this. In fact, we talked about on the rundown years ago, when Massachusetts decided to lighten up a little bit on non-competes. As I mentioned at that time, full disclosure, I've actually been the subject of non-compete action when I worked in Massachusetts in tech firms. And frankly, my opinion concurs with the government's position on this, as well, I should point out, as basically every reputable academic study of the question, and in that non-competes do stifle worker wages, limit worker mobility, and limit overall innovation in technology. One of the things that I've long wondered is how come the high-tech industry in Massachusetts and the high-tech industry in Silicon Valley didn't sort of follow the same path. My position is that it comes down to non-competes. Effectively, you have situations in California, a lot of stories, where people literally move to a company across the street or jump and start their own company and do amazing, innovative, and exciting things that would not have happened in Massachusetts because the employees would be worried about being sued or potentially even being blocked for years from working in the same industry. It's just not fair. Now, I'm not trying to say that non-competes are entirely illogical or make no sense anywhere. I could see for senior executives, maybe you might want to have a non-compete agreement, but I figure that it should be pretty rare. I felt like that's really what this whole concept was originally designed for, was to keep the CEO of this company from competing with the CEO of that company. But ironically, I feel like those are the people who are least affected by this law. My own experience in the tech industry has shown that non-competes overwhelmingly affect rank-and-file employees who, frankly, are not senior managers, should not be blocked from working in their field, and don't have the resources to fight it when they are. And when executives, who maybe you could make a case should be affected by this sort of thing, when they switch, there's usually not as much trouble because they see non-competes as just another negotiable item that they have to work through with their new company and their old company. And generally, they negotiate a compromise that lets them out of the non-compete agreement. In other words, this is just another way of businesses blocking their employees from doing things that their employees ought to be able to do, and it hurts everyone. So I'm really glad to see that the FTC is proposing this. I suppose it should have been an NLRB issue, but again, that's politics and I'm not a politician. And one more thing I should point out. First off, it hasn't gone into effect. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce is blocking it, predictably. And also, there is a carve-out here in that non-competes for senior executives making more than about $150,000 with strategic decision-making roles, that their existing non-competes are enforceable, but companies can't make new non-competes with new executives, and that those will expire after a few years. So I guess they are carving out a little bit here, but overall, this is a pretty comprehensive move. It's a pretty comprehensive block, and it's one that, frankly, academics, the government, and myself would support. How about you, Tom?
So I have to be the devil's advocate here, because a lot of people are thinking, oh, well, this is just going to create all kinds of problems because now I can go to work for Amazon and then learn all their secrets and then go over to Microsoft and implement all of Amazon's secrets at Microsoft. No, you cannot, because a non-compete is not a non-disclosure agreement. Those are two separate things. Everyone knows that an NDA means that I can't talk about something, right? You sign that non-disclosure agreement, and unless you're willing to violate those terms and be sued in court, you can't do that. What the problem is that people have been wielding non-compete clauses as overly broad NDAs to prevent people from going to work for competitors. And we see it all the time outside of the tech industry, right? If you work in a space where, let's just say you work for a reseller, you can't go work for another reseller for a certain period of time. Why? Well, the problem is that people think that customers are loyal to people, not companies. And so when you move from company A to company B, your customers will follow you. Well, there's ways around that. This covers those problems. What it doesn't cover is the NDA of, I went and I developed a whole bunch of research and created new products for this company, and now I'm going to go over and I'm going to replicate the same work at a different company, only I'm not going to have to do all the hard stuff first. I can just give them the end result. That is what an NDA is supposed to protect. That is what a patent is supposed to protect, right? But I have a question for you, Stephen. How many of these things do you see that are actually patented?
Well, that's the crazy thing, is that, you know, in my opinion, in my experience in this industry for quite a while, again, in my experience in this industry, I see non-compete used to restrict workers' movements, to stifle innovation, to stifle competition, and as a way for companies basically to butt heads, instead of as a way to actually serve legitimate business needs. As you say, trade secret misappropriation and non-disclosure and that sort of thing, those laws ought to exist They do exist, and they ought to be enforced. You shouldn't be able to take your employer's secret stuff and go to a new company and do the same thing. And, you know, that, of course not. And you obviously shouldn't be able to infringe upon patents. But what I see is that time and time and time again, non-compete clauses are used basically to punish the little guy. As you shouldn't quit, because if you quit, you can never work in computer networking. You know, you can't work for another computer networking firm. Good luck, buddy. Oh, you can't quit because, you know, I mean, you know, we compete with all the cloud companies. You know, you better not go to one of those companies. I mean, it hurts people. And as I said, I don't see this affecting a lot of executives except as an additional charge. I mean, one of the most famous non-compete cases was when Mark Papermaster left IBM and went to work for Apple. This was a huge, huge deal back in 2008. But it's important to remember that the case was non-compete, yes, but it was also trade secret misappropriation. So it wasn't that non-compete was the problem. It was that they were just adding this on as just another count. And frankly, that's what I see as the impact of this on executives. On the little guy, well, the little guy is not going to fight it, and he's just going to grin and bear it and stick with a job that he shouldn't stick with.
The hope from the FTC, assuming this ruling actually gets to be put into law, is that we're going to see far fewer cases where employees are forced to stay at a job because their likelihood of being employed in that same industry is going to go away in the event that they leave. It should also lead to higher wages because now companies will be more willing to give you a raise when they know they can't hamstring you from moving on. I do think that what it should also end up leading to is that a lot of these trade secrets will now become patented things, and it will reduce abuse of the patent system. Because now that you have to worry about whether or not an employee can leave and potentially disclose things, even if they are bound by an NDA, you want to get that protected under law. And I could wax intellectual about abuse of the patent system and trademarks and trade secrets and things like that. All you have to know is that the formula for Coca-Cola has never been disclosed because they don't want anybody to know what it is because they don't want anybody to get close to using it. But now, you know, we'll see if that changes the calculus of how companies want to address the situation with their employees. I think in the long term, this is going to be a very good thing, but I think it's going to mean a lot more NDAs for people, a lot more very stringent NDAs about very specific pieces, and could potentially lengthen the time that those NDAs are enforced. But, you know, that's a legal consideration, and I'm not a lawyer the last time I checked, so we'll have to see kind of how that falls out. Stephen, we have several events coming up in the space of Tech Field Day that I want to let people know about because this is a really exciting time for everyone. We are less than a month away from Mobility Field Day 11. We have a huge lineup of presenters, companies like Arista, Celona, Fortinet, Juniper, and we just added Ubiquiti and Eno to our list. So it's going to be a very packed 2 days of presentations. You can go to techfieldday.com to learn a little bit more about what's going on. And right after that, we have another event coming from you.
That's right. We've got App Dev Field Day coming up May 29th and 30th. We're going to be bringing a great group of independent technology folks together as our delegate panel. We're starting to make those announcements, so check out the Tech Field Day website as we announce the delegates that are coming to App Dev Field Day.
Then first week of June, we're going to be in Las Vegas for Cisco Live US. We're going to be doing Tech Field Day Extra there. We have presentations from our friends at Cisco. Of course, there are going to be some big announcements that we're going to want to dig into. And then we're going to be hearing from OpenGear as well. They're a longtime friend that participates during Cisco Live US. It's going to be a week of fun and hopefully not 100-plus degree weather. Maybe we could go take in a baseball game. That won't happen for a couple more years.
Not for a few more years, Tom. At that same time that you're at Cisco Live in Las Vegas, I'm going to be in Orlando for Click Connect. We've just announced that Tech Field Day is going to Click Connect. If you're in the data platform, analytics, business intelligence type space, check out clickconnect.com. You can learn more about the event, and I would love to see you there. Also, in June, we've got some exciting things going on. We've got our Cloud Field Day coming up June 12th and 13th. And of course, the annual 6.5 Summit, the biggest event on the Futurum calendar, is June 11th through 13th. And we're starting to make some announcements of the companies and speakers that are presenting there.
And then, of course, I'm happy to announce that we are going to be a part of HPE Discover this year. We're going to be doing Networking Field Day exclusive with Aruba. And you may have seen this week that they had a big announcement in the wireless space. If you haven't yet, go check out what they've been talking about, what they've been releasing. We're going to get a technical deep dive into all their new hardware and all of the new services that they're offering. This is the first time that the conference, formerly known as Aruba Atmosphere, is now a part of HPE Discover. I hear that we get to take in a keynote in the Sphere, and I am excited to spend my first time checking that out. Antonio Neri is going to rock the house. We know he will. And, you know, they're already announcing some big names that are going to be there. I believe I saw Jensen Huang is going to be a part of that keynote. So make sure you tune in for that, because we'll have coverage of the keynote, but we'll also have field day sessions, and we'll be talking all kinds of interesting networking technology. All right, that will just about do it for this episode of The Rundown. We want to thank everyone for tuning in. Remember that you can find us every week, whether you want to listen to us on our YouTube channel at youtube.com/GestaltITVideo. If you want to head over to GestaltIT.com to check out the show notes and some of the details behind the stories that we reference. And then, of course, if you want to listen to us in a podcast feed, just search for GestaltIT Rundown in your favorite podcast application. We'll be back next week, 1st of May, May Day, with some great news stories. Until then, for myself and for Stephen Foskett, thank you for joining us for this little jaunt through the news. We'll be back. Until then, take care of yourself, and we'll see you next week. We'll be right back.